It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Teen and preteen years can be difficult under any circumstances. At times confusing, scary, exciting, you name it, for both kids and their parents or guardians. Now throw in the online world and social media where kids grow up in a lot of ways in public. A lot of parents wonder how to help their kids manage all that without becoming 24/7 monitors of their online activity. Our next guest has advice, and she says it starts with mentoring, modeling, and building trust. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you talk to your kids about what they do online? What questions do you have about how to talk to your kids about what they do online? Has having kids with the internet made parenting easier, harder for you? If you are a young person yourself or were recently a teenager, love to hear your experiences navigating the world of social media and how your parents may have helped or hindered that. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Devorah Heitner is an author and speaker on technology and parenting in the digital age. She consults with schools about digital wellness policies and with app developers and tech companies on ethical practices. Her books include Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. Her newest book is called Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. Devorah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, you write that you are like me, a parent who grew up before the social media age, where we could make mistakes and know that they weren't going to go viral. Is there kind of a communication gap between, you know, parents of the pre-internet generation and the kids growing up just swimming in this stuff?
I think there is. And there's absolutely a lot of worry on parents' part that kids can go viral. And I think because we all lived our own mistakes in middle school, high school, and even college, we're very aware of the sort of youthful, dumb, indiscreet things that might happen and that we know, you know, are kind of universally part of growing up even. And so it makes us really nervous. A lot of parents are very nervous to think about the fact that a video or a photo of, you know, your kid that their friend posts could become a huge problem because it's so much more searchable and shareable than anything dumb that we did.
You get a lot of questions from parents, you write, that are pretty nuts and bolts. You know, should I use this kind of monitoring thing? Should I bar kids from using this platform? Whatever. And we'll talk some about those things. But you, I think, started a more fundamental place about how to parent to prepare kids for dealing with these issues. A shift, you say, from consequences to building character. Can you talk about what you have in mind?
Absolutely. You want to think about not, oh, you won't get into an elite college if you post that, because that's an external threat. And that's basically telling kids, don't get caught. What we actually want to say is don't do harm. Don't do things, you know, on Discord, on Instagram, on YouTube, on TikTok that are harmful, right? Don't malign a group of people or an individual. Don't do things that you know will cause hurt feelings or worse. Don't incite violence, right? And these are things that we know are really problematic. And we don't want to say don't do it because Harvard might rescind your admission. We want to say don't do it because we don't want to cause harm and we don't want to share things that might cause people to have the wrong idea about us and who we are. So if we can keep the conversation focused on character, it's more accurate, it's more developmentally appropriate, it's more true because frankly, you might do something that's pretty terrible and still get into an elite school and they just won't know. But that's, as a parent, that doesn't make me happy. I'm not like, oh, great, you got away with it. Right. The point is, who are you as a human being? So I think we need to shift that conversation to character and away from the threat of consequences.
I remember my teen years. I was not all that bright. I made dumb decisions sometimes impulsively. I'm sure if I had social media, I would have amplified them quite a bit. How do we work with a preteen or a teen to, I guess, take that step? To not be impulsive, to think about a consequence before doing stuff online.
It's tricky because it really does go against their neurobiology to not be impulsive. You know, teenagers are wired to think more about the rewards than the long-term consequences of an action. And so what we have to do is try to save them from themselves. And some of that maybe is not amplifying when teenagers make mistakes. We don't need to participate in amplifying that to reduce the harm factor. We can also look at things like in the UK and Europe, kids have the right to be forgotten. They can take things down that they posted when they were under 18. The realities of that with the internet, and I've talked to UK folks about this, it doesn't really fully work if your kid's involved in a tremendous scandal. It's still hard to pull that off the internet. But I do think the idea of thinking about not creating a permanent record of every dumb joke you ever said starting when you were 11 or 13 is a good one. And we as parents and educators in the US should be thinking about, like, what can we do from a policy perspective? Because the neurobiology and the technology, you know, intersect in a way that's pretty dicey for our kids.
One option people might think is maybe let's get out of the whole thing altogether. Say, kid, no device, no social media for you. Problem solved. What do you think of that approach?
I don't think that's a good strategy. I think kids need to know how to be citizens in digital communities. We can't just launch them at 18 and let them go off the deep end then. If anything, it's better to make your mistakes when you're young and learn about accountability in a digital community and communication strategies that work and how to resolve conflict when you're young enough to have a little bit more sort of forgivability, if you will, and a little bit less at stake. Like, say you're not going to hopefully blow up your career at 14, right? Hopefully that's, you know, still to come. So I think it's really important that we do teach kids how to be part of digital communities. I don't think we should push them in before they're ready, but I think school can be a great place to learn, for example, how to be part of a hangout or, you know, a shared document or other things in a community where you actually know the people involved before you get into digital communities where you don't know the other people, because that's sort of a next level experience. And ideally we can scaffold kids' experience growing more and more familiar with how to be participants in a digital community in a way that's appropriate.
Talking to Devorah Heitner about her new book, Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, maybe your own experiences as a parent or teen yourself. Join in at 800-642-1234. Devorah, I didn't end up doing a lot of monitoring with my kids. They're 20 now, so they're out the door. But I was amazed reading your chapter on options available for parents. There's a lot of ways to keep tabs on our kids online and social media and geolocation and so on and so forth. What do you recommend as parents survey that and think, yeah, maybe I should do this?
I think it's more important to talk to your kids and have a trusting, open relationship with your kids than anything else. And I think if you do monitor them, say you have a new phone user, I would do it with them. Like, if they're new at it and you want to look at their text with them, let's say, let's sit down together and look at your texts once a week or something until I see that you've got this. I don't think we want to use technology to surveil our kids. And particularly, we don't want to do it covertly. If we are monitoring, they should know we're monitoring. And in situations where they are being monitored by a third party like school, I do think it's fair to remind kids, hey, you know what, if you post this in the school Google chat, right, your teacher can see it. Like, I do think when kids are being monitored, they should know. If we covertly monitor our kids and go kind of all NSA, KGB on our kids, whatever, we are going to have a lot of data that we won't know what to do with. And the first time we share it with them, we're no longer covertly monitoring. We've ruptured trust. And we're often catching kids after they've made the mistake instead of before. What we want to do is teach kids how to make good choices, let them come to us if they've made a mistake that they need to kind of repair or move forward from. And we don't want to teach them that they can never repair a digital mistake. We've all made digital mistakes. Everyone listening to this has at least forgotten to BCC at some point and CC people and shared an email address with someone they shouldn't, or, you know, posted news on LinkedIn that wasn't public yet, or just something, right? I'm not saying, you know, tremendous digital mistakes, but we've all made some digital mistakes. And I think it's important that we don't teach kids that those can never be solved and they should be terrified, because in the most extreme scenario, that means that a kid who makes a digital mistake might feel desperate enough to contemplate ending their own life. What we want to do is obviously try to avoid the worst digital mistakes, talk to kids about planning for that, but also talk to them about how we can move forward and repair if we do share something we shouldn't.
One starting point that I loved in your book was not so much about what the kids are posting, but what the parents are posting about the kids. And of course, parents want to post baby pictures through graduation pictures and everything. You talk about the idea of, you know, negotiations as a family for what a kid is comfortable being posted about them and what they aren't. How do we approach that?
I think we need to be asking our kids permission by the time they can talk to us and give it. And when they're too little for that, we should, if in doubt, not share it out. Picture that 3-year-old running around in their underpants being adorable as a someday very self-conscious 13-year-old who will not appreciate that video being out there. So, you know, if in doubt, do not share it out. And by asking permission from our kids, we're actually setting up really great boundaries, and we're teaching them that we respect their privacy, and we're giving them the opportunity to recognize that you ask permission before you share someone's picture, which is something we want them to know before they start taking and sharing pictures of their friends.
We're talking to Devorah Heitner about her new book. It's called Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you dealt with this in your family, whether you're the parent or the kid, or a parent who used to be a kid dealing with these issues? What kind of boundaries, what kind of rules, what kind of conversations do you have in your household? What do you think about various ways to monitor kids' online activities? Do you need some advice from our guest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Devorah Heitner about a new book. It's called Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World, packed with advice for parents and teens and preteens about how to handle social media and the digital world. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Maybe you're taking our lesson to not share information publicly to heart, but if you have a story you'd be willing to share, like to share, you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you have a difficult experience with a teen posting something online that maybe they shouldn't have oughta? How did you handle that? What kind of things did you do to prepare your kids, or prepare if you were the kid in this situation yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. So what do we do, Devorah, when the bad thing happens? The kid posts something and it goes, you know, maybe not even internationally viral, but in their school viral or something like that, and causes harm and a lot of attention. How can we do some triage and try to fix things?
Yeah, I mean, I shared the story of the kids in Baraboo in the book, and some of you will remember that that's a situation where, you know, there was a photo in the community and some kids were making either white supremacist signs or a kind of Nazi Heil Hitler, you know, arm gesture, and it went around the world. And there are all kinds of ways that, you know, in the postmortem, we could think like they could have done better in that community to deal with what happened. But I think we all learn from situations like that. One of the tricky things is when something gets really big and it becomes national or international news, it becomes harder to have honest conversations in a community that might need to happen. Like, there were kids in that community who wanted to apologize and make amends and repair, which is what I think they should have happened and what in some cases did happen. And that's what I would want, you know, any kid to have the opportunity to do if they realize, like, wow, I made this significant error. I've hurt people by doing this. I want to come forward. But when it becomes a sort of media circus, it becomes harder because parents are like, want you to sort of stay away and hide. They don't want their kid to become known for this. So they don't want the kid to even come forward and apologize. So I think we need to make sure that kids have a way to make repair, make restitution as much as possible in the time and in the community where it happens. And then we need to let it go and move on, right? We need to make sure kids don't sort of pay and pay for the rest of their lives for like this one thoughtless moment, even though it's serious. Like, I'm not saying, and I want to be really clear, I'm not being an apologist for doing harmful things online or off, but I do think kids need to make the repair in the moment or in the community where it happens, not just a pro forma apology because they got caught, but really recognize and maybe do some further education as well for those kids. Maybe they didn't really understand the implications of referring to the Holocaust that way. Maybe the implications of white supremacy and the violence that entails weren't totally clear to them. And that's where we as school systems need to make sure we're showing up for our kids. When we see a kid use a slur or make a hateful gesture, we need to assume that they're the canary in the coal mine, and this is happening in a more widespread way in the community. And we need to make sure we're teaching kids the history of why those practices and words and gestures are so harmful. Not just focus all our outrage on that one kid, but make sure the entire community is addressed, and also make sure that the targeted community is supported. Right. So we have a lot of work to do when a kid's mess up in that kind of way. And I think what we end up doing often is throwing that one kid or those group of kids under the bus and saying, oh, we had a racism problem here in Baraboo, but we got those kids. We found out those kids. Let's share their faces everywhere. Instead of saying, wait a minute, like, do those kids not know the history? Where did we go wrong? And what can we do to support our neighbors who are targeted by this gesture?
Another thing that struck me about a communication gap that we talked about earlier, Devorah, is you talk to a lot of parents and a lot of youth. Parents often will say things like, it sounds like kids don't care about privacy anymore. But then when you talk to kids, there's a lot more nuance to how they think about privacy. What do you hear when you talk to teens who are using social media?
Kids will say that a practice is creepy if they find it creepy. So they'll say like someone going through all your old posts when they're your new friend is creepy and liking a really old post. Or they'll say that their parents, you know, sharing pictures of them or even worse, like reading their text is a real violation. So kids do care about privacy. The flip side is they're much more open about some things that in our generation were much more taboo and we didn't talk about. And that's one of the things I love about this generation is they are talking about mental health and other issues that we often kept private in our day. And even though, like when I was a teenager, I did see a therapist, I never told my friends because I just figured it was taboo. Like no one ever told me, no, don't tell anyone you have a therapist. I just kind of like got the memo because it was the 90s and nobody talked about going to therapy. And now I love that it's an option that kids could say, I'm going to therapy. And let me be clear that I think it's still fine if someone wants to keep and chooses to keep that private. But I love living in a world where so many of these things are more destigmatized and a kid could potentially say to their friends, oh, got to bounce. I've got therapy. And that's some of the kinds of things they're disclosing online where we might say, oh, they're oversharing. But I want to challenge adults who say that kids are oversharing to think about, are they oversharing or are they changing the culture in a more open direction?
Talking to Devorah Heitner about her new book, Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. You also have a chapter in your book devoted to concerns about sexting, which is maybe taking that openness to do things online a little too far. What do you want parents to know and talk to their kids about when it comes to sending sexually explicit images?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's illegal, right? So we know that, but it's more important to lean into the privacy and the social risks with kids with prevention, but we don't want to lean so far into prevention with sending nudes or explicit photos that our kids can't come to us if they have shared a photo, especially if that photo then is reshared without their consent, right? So I think I want to be clear, like, you know, none of us really want our kids to do this, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of privacy risks, there's legal risks, there's all kinds of risks, but it's especially important that kids don't coerce other kids into doing it or be coerced. And the research shows that the kids who experience the most mental distress and anguish are kids who get coerced or kids whose photos are shared outside of the original intended audience. In other words, two kids who are in love who exchange photos might not make us as parents happy and it's not technically legal, but if no one ever is the wiser, the mental health outcomes are often fine, right? I mean, there's still the same risks as if those kids did other things together in a relationship, but what's important to understand is when kids are coerced or their photos are shared to a wider audience without consent, that's a tremendous violation that can lead to a lot of mental health issues for kids and a lot of social issues and stigma. Unfairly, even in 2023, we see this land on girls more often where girls are shamed for their picture going around, whereas some boys will share pictures and not get shamed, or boys will share pictures and girls will maybe find it yucky or block them but not report it. So there's just a tremendous double standard around this stuff. And I think we really need to proactively educate our kids around consent, making sure they know they should never coerce someone, that if they have had their photo shared and it's violating their privacy, that they deserve help and we still respect them. We're not so focused on prevention and shaming kids that we don't let kids know, hey, you have rights here. If your photo of yourself that you took and shared with one person that you trusted and that person violates your trust, they messed up and you have rights. And there are things that as an adult, I can do to help protect you. I may never be able to get that photo back, let me be clear, but you know, we can get it taken down from any sites where it's been shared, especially because minors do have that right. And sites do not want to be hosting child pornography. So I think it's really important that our kids know that we still respect them, even if they've made a choice that maybe we're not jumping up and down about. if we lean too much into the fear factor with sexting, I the worry I have as an educator and a parent is that kids won't come to us if they need us.
In just our last little over a minute or so, Devorah, one thing that often gets overlooked is that, hey, our teen years are times where we're experimenting with our identity. We're kind of trying on different things. And that's a lot of what is happening on social media. How big a part of the story is that?
It's absolutely part of the story. And one of the tricky things is kids will do things to get a rise out of their friends or be outrageous. You know, like I talked to some kids in Chicago who like, oh, it would be hilarious to like throw a gang sign and have a picture of me doing it. And they're not affiliated. They have nothing to do with any of that. But it's going to make them vulnerable to have shared that image, right? But, or kids will, I talked to a family where the kid had shared a picture of themselves with some vape stuff and the kid didn't even vape. He just thought it would be hilarious to show with friends. And that's the tricky thing is with social, we're always talking to these different audiences and managing tremendously different contexts. And something that's funny to your three friends could get you in big trouble if someone else sees it. And that's so often what happens with social media. And it leads to, I think, tremendous misunderstandings and some consequences for kids that I think are often disproportionate to the intent of what they shared.
Devorah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Devorah Heitner is an author and speaker on technology and parenting in the digital age. We've been talking about her newest book. It's called Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. Still time for you to share what you've done in your own family, lessons you might like to share with others. You can always email us, ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Remember, you can share this conversation if there's somebody who you would like to have listen to some of the lessons from our guest today. Find it in our program notes over at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app for live streaming and our extensive archives. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The way we look at the world is often shaped by the colors we see. Color can convey an emotion, like red for anger or for love. It can tell us a temperature, like a cold blue. It can symbolize an idea, like green for nature. Sometimes our eyes can deceive us, and two people might look at the same object and see two different colors. There was that famous dress that went viral back in 2015 that people saw as either blue and black or white and gold. There's the less famous pair of shoes that I saw as gray, but everybody else in the whole world saw as brown. Many paintings or other artworks can create optical illusions with color that make you perceive the same color differently just based on what else is around it. Our next guest has spent years researching the way our eyes and our brains perceive colors to understand how it works and how it shapes the way we see reality. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you ever disagree with friends or family members about what color something is? Do you have questions about how we see colors, where we might get things wrong, how it all works in our minds? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Bevel Conway is a neuroscientist, artist, and senior investigator in the Perception, Cognition, and Action section of the National Eye Institute within the National Institutes of Health. Bevel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Rob.
You've devoted a lot of your work to studying color. What led you down that path?
I started as a kid, you know, when my mother's sister gave me my first set of real watercolors, you know, the kinds in tubes. When I was probably seven, and I just remember squeezing out these saturated pigments and watching the puddles just bleed into each other. And it was like, you know, better than movies. I got to create it. It was like I was the director of my own little movie. And I just was like, this is so cool.
Now, what actually is color? When young Bevel was looking at that paint color, what was happening?
Yeah, the question of what is color is perhaps the oldest question in psychology. It goes way back to the ancient Greeks. And, you know, what's really interesting is that there was this shift when we developed technology like cameras that made us think that we could take color out of the world. You could make a black and white picture. And, you know, before we had that technology, vision was color. That's all there was. It was, you open your eyes, you look around, the stuff you see around you is just color. It's like there. And so, you know, there's been this kind of interesting experiment that technology has done to us to make us think that color is somehow something we can pull out of the world, but it's really not. You know, your question is, what is color? It's lots of different things. And the way I like to think about it is it's really the interaction, the two sides of a coin between the stuff in the world and your mind. And it's kind of where those two things meet, make this thing we call color.
And different cultures, and I remember this back in school, different cultures might have more or fewer words for color, different ways of divvying up the spectrum. What do we see? How much variety is there out there in what cultures call colors?
There is a terrific variety in what different cultures call colors, the way they carve up what we think of as a color space. So, you know, some languages, they may only have two or three terms that everybody in the community knows that they can use to communicate colors. And other cultures, like, you know, English is one of them, we have probably 15, 20 terms that everybody in the society and the culture knows. You know, one of the old questions is whether or not that means that the people, the cultures that only have two or three color terms, do they not see those colors? And that is absolutely wrong. They definitely see those colors. They see all the colors that we see with our fancy color naming system. They just, you know, for one reason or another, they haven't sort of settled on needing to communicate what they see to each other.
What is going on in our brains when we get that visual input? What's going on to say, yeah, that's red, but that's blue, Rob?
Oh my God, that is the million-dollar question. So, you know, when you walk around, people have probably heard of rods and cones, the two types of photoreceptor cells in your eye. You can think of these as, you know, little eggs in an egg carton, a big cup egg carton, all facing the incoming light, you know, ready to catch it like a catcher in a baseball game. They're all sitting there waiting for their photon to arrive. And when, you know, in normal daylight, we only use the cones. So the rods are completely quiet or almost completely quiet. And so that means that the cone types that you have, the three cones you have in your eye, they are supporting everything you think of as vision during daylight. So they give you black and white vision and color vision and motion and faces and where you are in the world and everything you think of as vision. And those three cone types happen to be tuned to different parts of the rainbow. So you've got one that's tuned more towards shorter wavelengths, and then you've got two that are squished very close in, you know, their peak sensitivity is right in what we call yellow in the rainbow. And somehow your visual system sort of listens to these three cone types in the eye and says, okay, you know, I'm going to compare this one and this one and this one and this one, and I'm going to, you know, interpret those signals to be red or to interpret those signals to be blue. But there's a heck of a lot more that's going on than just a kind of straightforward code listening to those three cone types in the retina. There's all the stuff about what you expect to see, what you've seen before, whether or not, you know, that patch of light is next to another patch of light. You know, when you were an elementary school kid, and if you aren't still like me painting, you know, you remember putting a colored mark on the page, and then, you know, someone comes along and says, okay, now you filled in your apple with that color, now paint the background. And you go and paint the background, and all of a sudden the color you thought was perfectly good in the apple is now a different color. And you're like, ah, why did they do that? And that's because color isn't just related to the light coming to your eye from one little patch in the scene, in the painting. What you ascribe to that patch in the painting is actually a kind of unconscious summing together of everything that you are seeing right now and everything you've seen before.
We're talking about the science of color with neuroscientist Bevel Conway. You can join in with your questions, your experiences with perceiving, maybe misperceiving color at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Shelley is with us in Blanchardville. Shelley, hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I was just going to comment that every time we put paint on a wall, my husband and I definitely argue about what color it is and whether or not we need to run back to Menards to get a different version.
Yeah, who's right when you argue about this, Shelley?
Never him.
Thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate that. So what is the deal there? And I think a lot of people have had that experience where we disagree over what color something is. What's going on, Bevel?
Yeah. And, you know, there are a couple of different factors going on there. So one of them is, you know, when you go and you buy that, you get that paint sample from the wall and you put it on the wall, you know, are you painting the whole wall with that color before you decide what color it is? A lot of people, you know, get a little sample, they put it on the wall and they think, yeah, that looks good. And then they paint the whole wall and all of a sudden it doesn't look as yellow as you thought it was going to. So there can be some of this sort of, how good are you at picturing in your mind's eye what colors things will turn out? But, you know, one of the most interesting features of color is the gender asymmetry. So, you know, speaking in general terms, this certainly isn't true of all men and all women, but women tend to have more color terms than men, and they tend to kind of care more about it. They talk more about color terms or use color terms more often in language. It's almost like they're a little bit more attentive. And I'm in a same-sex family. I have a male spouse, you know, so we're sort of stuck just with the two of us trying to figure out what to do with our children and how to relate to them and make sure they get enough color terms. But one of the things that one of the experiments we ran a number of years ago was we asked people what colors things looked like when they sat inside a room that was illuminated with low pressure sodium light. I don't know if you're familiar with this light. It's that kind of eerie yellow light that they used to have in parking garages.
Parking ramps, yeah.
Yeah. And what's weird about that light is that your retina can't encode any color information. You're actually completely colorblind. And most people sort of don't notice right away. They're like, something's weird. I don't know exactly what's going on. And when we tested men and women in this environment, the women were much more likely to be like, there's something fishy. No, I can't see color properly. And your face, wow, that looks really green and weird. And the men were like, you know, they'd mark down on a little display what they were seeing. And exactly what they were seeing looked just like what the women were seeing. They just were not particularly inclined to tell us about it.
We are talking to National Eye Institute neuroscientist Bevel Conway about how we see colors, the way our color perception shapes our reality. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think a lot about the role of colors in your day-to-day life, maybe your line of work? If you're colorblind, love to hear from you about how that affects your life. Join in with your experiences or questions about color at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Bevel Conway, neuroscientist, artist, and senior investigator at the National Institutes of Health. He's with us today to share his research into how we see color and the ways our color perception can affect our everyday lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Got an email from Emmanuel in Strawberry Point, Iowa. Emmanuel writes, when I go from a bright room into a dimly lit room, I see what's there fine, but with a slightly different overlay of small red dots with yellow circles around them and green circles around those. Are these my cones continuing to fire at full blast? He says, I don't have diabetes or any visual abnormality. Is that a thing, Bevan?
Well, that is very interesting. It's definitely not your single cones. They would fire with two. You know, that if you activate a single cone at a time, the dot of light that you would see is so small that most people wouldn't notice it. There is a technique now that's being used to try and do that. And I actually had my retina stimulated with single photons of light not too long ago just to see what it's like. My guess is that it's probably related to the blood vessels that carry red blood cells in the blood vessels in front of the eye. And there's, you know, they're refracting a little bit of light, and that may be what you're seeing. But it's an interesting observation.
Thanks for that note. Let's go back to our callers now. Sam is with us in Chautauqua. Sam, hi.
Going back to the lady that said she and her husband can't agree on colors.
Oh, we lost Sam. We got a note. He told our producer that the True Value Hardware there won't allow men to buy paint unless he's got a signed certificate from his wife. Okay. Sorry we lost you, Sam. That actually reminds me of a follow-up bubble. You mentioned that, you know, at least in American culture, women have more words for color, more interest in it. Do we know, is this something biologically brain-based? Is this a social thing? Women are brought up to be more interested in these colors. Do we have a why behind that?
It's probably a social thing. In fact, it's almost certainly a social thing. One of the big questions in our business is, why do we have color? And some of your listeners might be like confused. Why is there a color expert at the National Institutes of Health? That seems weird. and the answer is that color is one of the first things that first aid responders will notice when they look at someone. You know, they're called to attend to someone who's in duress, and one of the first things they'll look at is the color of their skin, because it tells you a lot about someone's health status. When our children were brand newly born, they were tiny little preemies, and they spent 2 months in the NICU, and the nurse, the senior nurse, came by on the first day and said, you know, I know a lot of new parents just are itching to put some clothes on their babies, but we can't do that because we need to see the color of their skin in order to know how healthy these children are. And, you know, if they take a nosedive health-wise, we'll see it right away in the skin, which we won't see necessarily or hear in the monitors. And so, you know, you can build up a kind of cultural story that in America, historically, traditionally, you know, women have been more assigned to a kind of caregiving role. And so maybe they're sort of through cultural acclimatization and so on, more likely to care about color in that way. But certainly, you know, men are perfectly capable of having the same level of color as women. There is one way in which it's biologically determined that men can have sort of worse color vision. And that's that, you know, red-green color blindness is genetic and is carried on the X chromosome. And since men only have one X chromosome, if they've got a screw up on that X chromosome, it shows up as red-green color blindness. So red-green color blindness is much more common in men than it is in women. But the sort of disagreements that, you know, husbands and wives are having at the paint shop, those are very unlikely to have to do with, you know, genetic color blindness.
Let's go to Carol now in De Pere. Carol, hi.
Hi. I have a question about light perception. I've only had light perception for several years now. Lost all detail in color vision. But I see yellow, like today the sun is out, I guess. So I see everywhere yellow. And if it's a cloudier day, it might be a grayish yellow. Is that just the visual cortex of the brain rather than anything with the retina?
What's the nature of your sort of health history? Have you lost most of your vision? Is this acquired? This is a new thing?
It's not new. I was low vision my whole life. I was a preemie with an oxygen problem. But I had vision enough to get through college and work. But now it's down to just light perception. And, you know, I do everything by audio now.
Interesting. Uh-huh. Carol, thanks for sharing that experience. Bevel, is this something you've encountered before?
So it could be a number of different things. And obviously, I'm not you know, examining a patient right now. So I would caution against taking too seriously whatever I say. But, you know, as we age, one of the things that happens to your lens, that's the, you know, the focusing part of the focusing apparatus inside your eye, is that it yellows. And it could be possible, most people adapt to the yellowing of their lens with age, but it could be possible that that is something that's contributing to her experience.
Thanks a lot for sharing that experience, Carol, at 800-642-1234. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I've always wanted to say this. There's something dysfunctional when I see someone adding blue food coloring to a mini golf course waterfall or a casino pool or something. They don't need to add blue, but they want to add blue because they want people to perceive it as, you know, like a pristine blue pool of water. Mm-hmm. Water is clear.
Jeff, I worked at my uncle's swimming pool store back in the day. Yeah, there is a bluer, I can't remember what they call it, but a bluening project product that you can add to water. We really want to perceive water as blue, Bevel, even though it's transparent, I guess.
I love the observation. I know in Chicago, I was there one year where they had their St. Patrick's Day parade, and they filled the river there with green, or the canal, with green paint. And it was the most disconcerting visual experience. The blueness of water is interesting. The reason people like or think of water as being blue is obviously it's usually reflecting a blue sky, because the water functions as a very strong reflector. And so we have a kind of deeply ingrained association of blue and water. And I think that's probably where that impulse comes to try and fill it with blue coloring. But trying to match the color of the water to the color of the sky is a challenge, because, of course, the sky is constantly changing its color as the clouds go by. So I think what people don't anticipate is that when you look at the water, what you're really doing is stitching together the color that you're seeing in the water with the color of the sky in that instant. And that's what you're sort of after, is that kind of cohesion of a visual experience.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Okay, Bevel, here's something I had to bring up, because whenever I mentioned to people the topic of this conversation today, they talked about a time in their life, sometimes as a little kid or maybe as a college student or whatever, where they wondered, do I see the color, say, red, the same way other people do? And like, it's a mind-wrecking philosophical quandary for them that I'm guessing you get asked about all the time, probably. What do you say to people when they bring that up?
Yeah, it's one of the oldest questions. It was raised first by John Locke, who is a philosopher, British empiricist philosopher, who asked, you know, when I look at a marigold flower, is it the same as you looking at a violet, you know, one of those violet colors? And the answer is, we can't really know for sure, but we do have some pretty darn good clues. The first is, you know, if really you experience color very differently from me, then we wouldn't have a conceptual framework that would allow us to have a meaningful conversation. And in the old days, it used to be thought that it's conceivable you could see a different color because maybe the tuning properties in your retina might be different. But now we know what the tuning properties are, and we know that they're consistent from person to person. So there's a pretty darn good chance that when you see red, I'm seeing the same thing. We do have some brain imaging data where we compare from one person to the next and show that there's a similar pattern of response in the two people. But, you know, the question is a hard one. And the reason it's a hard one is that we were astounded to discover that there is more brain, cerebral cortex, you know, the thinking part of your brain, involved in color perception. There's as much involved in color perception as there is involved in face recognition. So you have a lot of brain doing color, and it tells us that color is something really deep and fundamental to the human experience. So I'd find it hard to imagine that, you know, evolution would go to all the trouble to make all of that brain and have it spit out some random piece of noise that didn't mean anything to you and me.
It's a good place to leave it. Bevel, thanks a lot for sharing your research with us.
My pleasure. This has been fun.
That's Bevel Conway, a neuroscientist, artist, and senior investigator in the Perception, Cognition, and Action section of the National Eye Institute within the National Institutes of Health. He joined us today to talk about how we see colors and what colors tell us about the world around us. If you're wondering what art created by a neuroscientist who studies color looks like, you can follow his work at bevelconway.com. Let's get a link to that up on the program note. You can find that at wpr.org/centraltime. cool 3D stuff. If you have a funny story to share about a disagreement over color, you can still share that. Email ideas@WPR.org. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, more Americans are getting diagnosed with sleep apnea. Two sleep doctors join us now to talk about how to diagnose and treat that condition. That's coming up in a couple minutes. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Sarah Hopeful with a story about a musician who played a big role in Wisconsin's musical history.
Drummer Viola Smith was a musical trailblazer and innovator. Known as the fastest girl drummer in the world, her career lasted almost 100 years. Author Dean Robbins took a trip to her hometown in Fond du Lac County to tell us more about this legend.
Mount Calvary has only a few hundred residents, but it produced a drummer of national significance. She was born in 1912, and if you stop modern-day residents on the main drag, they still know her name.
Viola Smith.
Viola Smith's father owned a ballroom in Mount Calvary, and townsfolk showed me where it once stood on Fond du Lac Street. Mr. Smith enlisted his older daughters for the jazzy Smith Sisters Orchestra, featuring trumpet, trombone, and saxophone. By the time Viola was ready to join the family band at age 13, she told the Women in Rock Oral History Project that it still lacked a key instrument.
And he had these eight girls all play piano, and then he'd put them on different instruments. And I was so lucky to be the sixth one. As a sixth one, I was a drummer.
Young Viola tried smacking the snare and socking the cymbals, and she fell in love with the drums. The Smith sisters went on the road in the 1920s as a rare all-female band at Wisconsin fairs and vaudeville theaters. Viola studied other drummers on the circuit and developed her own flashy way of playing. One by one, Viola's sisters left music for other pursuits. But she yearned to keep playing, even though female instrumentalists were not welcome in most male orchestras. So in 1939, Smith formed her own women's jazz band called the Coquettes to showcase her razzle-dazzle style. She placed her 12-piece kit on a tall platform with a giant tom-tom by each shoulder. This innovation wowed the crowds when Smith rapped out rhythms at blazing speed. To end the numbers with a flourish, she bounced her sticks off a drum head and caught them in midair. Smith's fame spread as a technical marvel, earning her the nickname the fastest girl drummer in the world. In 1940, Billboard magazine splashed her on its cover. She remembers that time with the Women in Rock Oral History Project.
That I was doing something that nobody else was doing, and that's what helped me a lot, I'm sure.
In 1942, men were leaving jazz bands to fight in World War II, and Smith saw a chance to boost women instrumentalists. She wrote an influential article for Downbeat magazine called Give Girl Musicians a Break. It urged band leaders to hire these overlooked players.
Oh, the girl musicians were so happy about this because I mentioned so many girl names, all the girls I knew. Good musicians.
Smith later toured as a solo act with a spectacular 17-piece drum kit. She even studied classical music at Juilliard and joined the National Symphony Orchestra as a timpanist. In 2000, Lincoln Center for the Arts honored her as a jazz legend. Smith continued to smack her snare and sock her cymbals past the age of 100, defying our conventional view of older women. She died in 2020 at the age of 107, a hero to generations of female instrumentalists who followed her into the music business. It's no wonder people still know Viola Smith's name in Mount Calvary. Who could forget the fastest girl drummer in the world?
was all fun. But drumming is fun.
Author Dean Robbins of Madison brought us that story on Viola Smith. He's written a children's picture book about the musician, the fastest drummer. Clap your hands for Viola Smith. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Sarah Hopeful.
This is Central Time. Obstructive sleep apnea is a common condition for many Americans. According to some estimates, as many as 30 million people could have it. But a lot of those 30 million may not know they have it. Sleep apnea disrupts breathing at night, leads to poor sleep quality, and can lead to other health conditions. But a lot of people go undiagnosed for years. Two doctors who specialize in sleep medicine join us now. They're here to help us understand the risk factors, diagnosis, and treatment for sleep apnea. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have sleep apnea yourself? Was it easy to get diagnosed? Did it take a while? Do you use a CPAP machine at night? How has that affected the quality of your sleep? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Tarif Smadi is a pulmonologist and sleep medicine specialist with Aurora Healthcare. Dr. Smadi, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, welcome. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Stacey Ishman is a pediatric ear, nose, and throat doctor and sleep surgeon at UW Health. Dr. Ishman, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Smadi, can you give us the basics on sleep apnea, especially this most common kind, obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA? What is going on when we have that?
As you've alluded to earlier, obstructive sleep apnea is a very common condition. It really affects a huge segment of the population worldwide. It's estimated to be around 20 to 30% of the general population in some studies. And it tends to span all the spectrum of ages, from children all the way to the elderly. And obstructive sleep apnea is the most common type of apneas by definition. And basically, there is a narrowing of the upper airway, which is the anatomical space, starting with the nasal airway all the way to the tongue level behind the tongue base specifically. So during wakefulness, the airway is always maintained open through some muscle groups and toning of that airway through directly controlling it neurologically. However, in individuals who have obstructive sleep apnea, sleep state kicks in, the tone of the airway and the patency of the airway becomes compromised to a level where there is a cessation of airflow sometimes, and that's how the breathing is affected.
And Dr. Ishman, what is that going to look and sound and feel like for that person? What are some of the earliest warning signs that, hey, I might have sleep apnea?
Yeah, so what's interesting about this is it's totally different in adults and kids. I think we're all familiar with the roommate who snores too loud and maybe makes it hard for you to sleep. That's very typical in adults. Oftentimes, they may have gasping or pausing in their breathing. And oftentimes, morning headaches, they may feel tired during the day. That's really typical for adults. For kids, they might actually be hyperactive. It is the rare child who will tell you that they're tired in the morning. My children will fall asleep swearing that they're not tired. And so it's interesting that it looks different in those two groups, but pausing, gasping, choking, and daytime sleepiness are really, really significant findings for sleep apnea.
And Dr. Smadi, a disrupted sleep, that's bad enough in and of itself. I understand that sleep apnea can raise risks for serious health conditions down the line. What are some of our worries of long-term untreated apnea?
Yes, absolutely. In multiple studies now, it's been confirmed that sleep apnea drives significant risk for cardiovascular disease in general. The strongest link is to elevated blood pressure or hypertension. There are increased risks for cardiovascular events in general, from heart attacks, congestive heart failure, arrhythmias, even the risk for stroke is higher. Not to mention, there are the rare cases where there's sometimes sudden death during sleep due to severe sleep apnea.
Dr. Ishman, suppose somebody comes into the doctor reporting some of these symptoms. What are some of the next steps toward diagnosis?
So one thing I want to add is that in kids, oftentimes it's school performance and some other things. So in adults, I totally agree with everything that Dr. Smadi said. But when you think about next steps, really diagnosis is key. So I think Dr. Smadi mentioned that there's a number of conditions that can cause similar daytime symptoms. It may be that you're looking at hyperactivity, which can overlap with this. And maybe you're looking at congestive heart failure, which can overlap with this. And so a sleep study is really the first thing for us to figure out what's exactly going on with a patient and to differentiate obstructive versus other diseases in terms of sleep apnea.
We are talking about sleep apnea. Dr. Stacey Ishman is with us from UW Health. Dr. Tarif Smadi from Aurora Healthcare. We're looking at how sleep apnea is diagnosed, what it can do to you, and coming up, how we treat it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this the story of your life? Are you or is someone close to you dealing with sleep apnea? What were some of the first signs? What did it take to get diagnosed? Have you found treatment that seems to be helping? Join in now with your experiences or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Dr. Tarif Smadi from Aurora Healthcare, Dr. Stacey Ishman from UW Health, both sleep specialists. We're looking at the risks of sleep apnea, how it's diagnosed and treated. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use a CPAP machine? Has that affected the quality of your life? Have you tried a different alternative? What questions do you have about sleep apnea? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I have sleep apnea, and I'm wondering about this new gadget, I guess you could call it. It's called Inspire, and it's implanted in the shoulder. And they said you don't have to wear a mask or anything because you use this instead. What can you tell me about it?
Okay, thanks for the call. Dr. Smadi, let's start with you. I had seen a write-up on this. I hadn't heard of this before, but this implant to treat sleep apnea. What do we know about it?
Yes, the hypoglossal nerve stimulator, as we call it, is an FDA-approved option for a selected group of obstructive sleep apnea patients. So there is a specific criteria that patients must meet in order to be considered for this specific therapy. And while it is effective, the data suggests that there are weight limits. Patients have to be within specific BMI range. There's also specific anatomical descriptions that have to be met based on examination using sedated endoscopy. So it's not for every patient. And CPAP, on the other hand, remains superior and more universal. Now, the specifics about the hypoglossal nerve stimulator, it is a generator that is implanted under the chest wall, typically on the right side of the chest wall, similar to a pacemaker. And the ENT surgeon will connect this generator with the hypoglossal nerve, which sits right under the chin on both sides. We only stimulate one side, typically the right side, and this is activated via remote control that the patient have access to. And when they're ready to fall asleep, they simply turn it on. And electrical stimulation at a very low voltage is delivered to the hypoglossal nerve that controls the largest tongue muscle.
Wow.
And that's how the therapy works, by advancing the tongue in a more forward position, keeping the airway more open.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Ishman, Dr. Samadi referenced the CPAP. Now, some people out there are very, very familiar with the CPAP, probably because they use it every night. For people who aren't, can you tell us a little bit about the CPAP, what it does, what it is?
Sure. Although I will say I'm actually an ENT surgeon who places Inspire. So
oh, you do?
It's interesting. Yeah. So interesting. So
I'll start with it's really useful. How common is it since you're doing these surgeries that people are getting that?
Yeah, I think it's actually becoming more and more common. But I think Dr. Samadi's comment that there's a select group where it works the best for is a really good one. And it's people who are in a BMI under 35 and who have between 15 and 100 events an hour of obstructive sleep apnea. And so there are plenty of reasons that CPAP is really, really, really useful. And I think his comment about when you can use it, it is more effective than anything else out there. And so the contrast is really great. I'm also a sleep medicine physician in addition to an ENT. And so I have lots of patients who have come to me for the Inspire, and we've done some procedures, mostly nasal, so that they can breathe better through their nose and use their CPAP more effectively. And about half of people who get a CPAP use it really effectively, and about half have some challenges. And so we work really hard to make sure that that technology works because it can be very effective. But when it's not effective, something like the Inspire can be really useful if you meet the criteria. And so he made a really good point. You have to make sure that both your sleep study and weight, honestly, make you a good candidate. But it can be really a great salvage therapy, meaning if you can't use some other things like dental appliances or CPAP, it can work great, including in the group with Down syndrome, which is the latest group that's been approved for its use.
And Dr. Ishman, I want to stay with you in surgery for a moment. I, as a teenager, had deviated septum surgery. It wasn't the most fun few weeks of my life, but is that something that we do to help with some cases of apnea?
So most of the data shows that if you do nasal surgery, like a deviated septum, or there's bones in our nose called turbinates, which we can make smaller, that is really effective in helping us use CPAP better. There is some pediatric data that suggests if you do that surgery, you can reduce the number of pauses an hour you have by up to 10 events an hour. And there's an adult meta-analysis that also suggests up to 11 events an hour, but most adults have far more than that. And so we don't really characterize sleep surgery as nasal surgery. We think it really helps use CPAP for people who don't have sleep apnea, but actually the snore can really reduce snoring. So it can make your spouse much happier or your friends who live with you. But it is predominantly something that we use to make it easier to use other therapies.
Let's go back to our callers. Kathy is with us in Chippewa Falls. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share, it took a while for me to convince my husband he needed a sleep study, but his snoring would rattle the windows and kept me awake. And I did notice that he would stop breathing. He finally got one. And it's made a world of difference. The snoring is gone. And the one thing that we didn't expect to happen was he used to get up and go to the bathroom maybe three or four times a night. And that stopped. So we are both now getting a full night's sleep, and it's fabulous.
And does he, and I guess you too, Kathy, feel better in the daytime too because of that?
I love it. Yeah.
Kathy.
Yeah, I'm so happy that he finally went ahead with it.
Thanks so much for sharing that. I have some relatives who do CPAP. Dr. Samadi, it can be a real life-changing event when you get this thing, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's like you described it. It is a life changer. And the majority of CPAP users, when they are able to tolerate it, they report improvement. And that, of course, is subjective and varies tremendously between different patients. But in general, the outcome is always excellent.
Thanks again for the call, Kathy. Dr. Ishman, you work with kids. I imagine it might be difficult at the early going to get a kid to adjust and be willing to wear that CPAP. What does it take to make that happen?
You know, I'm going to be honest. I think we just worry they're going to be hard doing it. the compliance rate in kids is pretty much the same as the compliance rate in adults. And in fact, in kids with Down syndrome, it's slightly higher than it is in adults. So It turns out our kids listen to us. Don't tell my kids, they don't listen to me. But what really I think happens is it's about the attitude of the caregiver. So if you're optimistic about it working, I think you're much more likely to get kids to be able to use it.
Excellent. Now, are there lifestyle changes, Dr. Somadi, that we can do maybe for a milder apnea condition that doesn't rise to the level of a CPAP? Are there sleep hygiene things that we can do that might make a difference?
Yes, absolutely. Some of the tips we tell our patients to do is always emphasize the benefit of weight loss. While this is a difficult goal to achieve for a lot of people, but it's still useful. Even if it's few pounds, it can make a big difference in the severity and the burden of snoring and apnea. Also, avoiding sleeping supine or on the back, that is also very protective, because when we are on our backs, we're more prone and vulnerable to obstructive sleep apnea. So sleeping side, favoring a side is also helpful. And the last thing that I can add is we tell patients to try to sleep with the head of the bed slightly elevated. That also reduces the gravity effect on the tongue, allowing for more open airway.
And Dr. Ishman, just a half minute left. Can you give some encouragement to people who might be on the fence of whether they should get that sleep study?
No, absolutely. I think that the most important thing is to understand what's going on. So if you're snoring versus sleep apnea, very different options for treatment. Figure it out, whether it's your partner that you're poking to get out of bed or your child who you're worried is not doing as well in school. I think it's really critical to understand what's going on with their sleep. So thank you so much for giving us the time to talk.
And thanks to both of our guests. We've been talking to Dr. Stacey Ishman, pediatric ear, nose, and throat doctor and sleep surgeon at UW Health, and Dr. Tarif Somadi, pulmonologist and sleep medicine specialist at Aurora Healthcare. Been talking about sleep apnea, how it's diagnosed, how it can affect us, and various kinds of treatment. Still time for you to share your story. If you have one, you can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around, there's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.